Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Pak Jeon-do, the hero in The Orphan Master's Son, is not actually an orphan, but he is one of North Korea's many faceless citizens. His adventure takes us from primitive villages to darkened DMZ tunnels to inhumane labor camps. But working with such grim material has not stopped Adam Johnson from writing a surprisingly fun thriller. He joins us to talk about his new book. You are welcome to join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And good morning, Adam.
Good morning to you, too.
It's good to have you here. Adam, tell me when you first went to North Korea.
I traveled to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in 2007. It used to be quite impossible to get there as an American. The time I went, it was quite difficult. Now, because they're so starved for hard currency because of the desperate times there, they're advertising this summer trips from the KITC for American passport holders. They'll allow anyone of the great enemy nation to come in if you pay cash.
Tell me what you saw.
Well, I think the country's in great flux, and what I saw in 2007 was probably a time capsule, because I've talked to people who've been there just recently, and things are different. But it's really hard to get a sense of that place. First of all, I flew there on Koryo Airlines, the most dangerous airline in the world, the only one to get 1 star out of 5 for safety from the FAA. I flew on an old Soviet Ilyushin from 1963. And, you know, when we went out over the sea, instead of flying over open water, they followed the coast all the way up and around until they hit the train tracks that went from Shenyang down to Pyongyang, which told me the pilots didn't really have navigational equipment. When you arrive in North Korea, many things strike you right away. There are no planes in the sky. There's only the once-a-week flight from Beijing and the twice-a-month from Vladivostok. We, I think, are so inured to having contrails above us. It's eerily quiet. There are no cell phones. There are no pets. There are very few automobiles, so there's no need for stoplights. There's no advertising. And I didn't quite realize how much, as an American, I was used to seeing a message for commerce on every surface.
Did you deliberately go there because you planned to write this book? Were you already in the midst of it?
I'd been working on the book for about 2.5 years at that point.
Did the authorities know that?
Not at all. Not at all. That wouldn't be something I could advertise. So I wanted to go there to get that verisimilitude, those real-life details you'd never know unless you were there.
And one of the things you wrote about in The Daily Beast was such a stunner, a photograph that you have in your head of seeing people in the back of a truck.
That's right. You know, when I landed at Sunan Airport, it's about 25 kilometers north of Pyongyang, and I drove with my minders. I just met them. They turned out to be wonderful, bright, interesting people. And as I was heading south toward the capital, I had a fascination with North Korean vehicles because they play a really important role in life there. The Soviets had built many car factories there that the North Koreans can keep running but not improve. So they make a truck called the Sungli 58, and in 2012 they're making brand new vehicles from 1958, which is a real metaphor for the country, I believe. So when I saw my first vehicle after driving for maybe 10 minutes on an open road, I was really excited, and I stuck my head out the window, and it was a truck. And it came toward me. It turned out to be one I didn't recognize, but it was filled with humans in the back. about 3 dozen folks, and there was no tailgate to the back of the dump truck, so everyone was crowded up against the cab, lest a bump toss them out. And in just a glimpse as they passed, I saw a man in a Vinilon sport coat. They have a material they're very proud of there that's made of a fiberglass-like material. And he was carrying a briefcase, and beside him was a woman in a lab coat, like perhaps she was a doctor or a researcher. And they whooshed by. And I turned to my minder, and I asked her, I said, "Who are those people? Where are they going?" And she said, "Oh, they're volunteering to help with the harvest." And I just wondered, who would take a briefcase with them to volunteer to pull rice? And I said, "They're really volunteers?" And she said, "Everyone must volunteer here." And that's when I kind of realized the reality of this place I'd researched was actually true.
The idea of everyone volunteering brings to mind the images that we here in this country saw at the death of Kim Jong-il. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting that everything is so regulated that perhaps those who were profuse in their grief were also volunteers?
Well, that's a great way to phrase it. When we think about North Korea, I think we have to think about the notion of a national narrative there that's much different than ours. As a writer and a reader and a teacher of creative writing, this notion of narrative became one of my touch points of fascination for writing about North Korea. As an American, and in the stories Americans tell themselves, each person is the center of his or her own story. We're all supposed to be the center of our own lives. And no matter how much we love the people around us, they're really secondary characters. But in American stories and in American life, we're supposed to be an individual, to define ourselves, to discover our own needs and desires, and to move forward in life in an attempt to attain those things, and therefore to define ourselves. And when we meet obstacles or complications, we look inward or into the past, and we grow and change and attain wisdom. But in North Korea, it's just the opposite. There's one story. It's written by the regime, by Kim Jong-il himself, actually, and Kim Il-sung before him, and now Kim Jong-un. And in that story, there's one beatific, benevolent leader bringing a nation forward into prosperity. And that leadership assigns roles to everyone else in the country. And that makes a nation of millions of secondary characters. And to be a secondary character, which is your role in North Korea, as a child, your aptitude towards certain things are ascertained from a young age, and you're directed down paths where you might be a fisherman or a soldier or a singer. And in that world, to have your own needs and desires is a detriment to fulfilling your role.
Will you read for us from the start of the book?
From the very beginning?
No, where you have chosen.
Oh, yes. When Comrade Buck was gone, Dr. Song turned to Jun Do. "Where we are from," he said, "stories are factual. If a farmer is declared a music virtuoso by the state, everyone had better start calling him maestro. And secretly, he'd be wise to start practicing the piano. For us, the story is more important than the person. If a man and his story are in conflict, it is the man who must change." Here Dr. Song took a sip of juice, and the finger he lifted trembled slightly. "But in America, Jun Do, people's stories change all the time. In America, it is the man who matters. Perhaps they will believe your story, and perhaps not. But you, Jun Do, they will believe you."
Tell us about Jun Do.
Well, he is an orphan at the beginning of the story.
He's not really an orphan.
Well, I've linked the perspective very close to him and limited it to what he knows of the world. And it's his belief that he's actually the son of the orphan master. And because my narrator has a close allegiance to him, I don't think we can quite tell. But he starts off as a model citizen. He's been assigned a secondary role in his nation. It's often a grim role. Unfortunately, to be an orphan in North Korea, and there are many, is to have no advocates in the world, and you're not going to get adopted, likely. You're really more like child labor until you're old enough to join the military, and at that point you're assigned more of the dangerous tasks in the world.
And he is indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see episodes in his life in which he is a tunnel soldier, and the tunnels under the DMZ are quite famous. They're gigantic. They're made to move 10,000 men an hour into South Korea from the north. They're quite extensive, and there's many that we keep discovering all the time in the South. He also spends time as a kidnapper of Japanese citizens.
Why?
Well, all the kidnappings that take place in my book are based on actual ones, and in the 70s and 80s especially. Because North Korea had so insulated itself, it didn't really know anything about the outside world. So they couldn't even go to other countries and act normally. They didn't know the cultural nuances of other societies. So they would go steal people, fetch them back to Pyongyang, learn about how things worked in Japan and the Philippines and South Korea, and then train their agents to be able to move amongst people of other societies.
But would they keep them for years?
For their lives, yes.
For their lives.
Yes, they could never return. There were actually a couple famous returns in 2005. The Japanese government is quite upset about this. And it's really astonishing that, you know, our former president went to the DPRK to secure the release of two American journalists, but left other citizens from other countries there as well.
Adam Johnson, his new book, The Orphan Master's Son. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Writer Adam Johnson has a new novel. It's all about North Korea, its mysteries, its humor, its people, its prisons. It's titled The Orphan Master's Son. He's here in the studio with me. I do invite your calls, comments, 800-433-8850. Adam Johnson is also the author of the short story collection Emporium and the novel Parasites Like Us. He teaches creative writing at Stanford University. Why and how, Adam Johnson, did you first become interested in or obsessed enough with what was going on in North Korea to devote 5 years of your life to writing this novel?
I did become obsessed. I began just as a reader. I think I read a couple books that really surprised me, that made me aware that there was the grimmest reality possible on the other side of the earth. I read The Aquariums of Pyongyang by Kang Chol-won, the testimonial of a person who was in Yodok, Camp 15, a gulag that's operating right now as we speak with 50,000 inhabitants in it, in the DPRK. It's a family prison, so when you're sent there, your children go, and your parents go. And that's how the true control takes place in North Korea, that if someone around you does something bad, the fates of everyone are included. And that begins a process of self-censorship and everyone keeping control over one another for familial safety. I became just kind of obsessed with these narratives. I began reading the stories of defectors about what their lives were like, how they survived, the kind of unbelievable choices they had to make over a matter of course of survival. And I began wondering, I began thinking that this was the most difficult place in the world to be fully human, that if anything you do can be used against you, that if spontaneity is not possible, I wondered how people shared their inner thoughts. When did they whisper their doubts or questions to others? When would they take a risk, you know, to reveal their hearts?
And are you saying that the only way you could truly discover that was through fiction?
Well, I do believe that that's the great power of literary fiction, is to fill in the human dimension, you know, where it's not easily obtained. One of the first things I did was trying to find a book by a North Korean. And, you know, I went to Stanford's Green Library and asked them for a novel by a North Korean, and they just rolled their eyes. I did get my hands on a few books, but they were state-sponsored, commissioned by the state, with the approval of the censors. And, of course, the whole point of them is to glorify the regime, which they did. But to my knowledge, from my research, we don't have a literary novel written by someone in the DPRK in the last 60 years, which means either the books are being written and they don't get out, or no one's risking it. And that means no one's read a book as we understand it.
So when you were there in 2007, aside from or in addition to being with your minder,
that's right,
did you have any other contacts?
Well, it's not legal for a citizen of the DPRK to interact with a foreigner without special training. So I knew that if I attempted to have like a genuine interaction with someone, it could, you know, put them in jeopardy.
Sure.
That was the last thing I would want. So really, I had to look through the veil of my minders to try and glean something about themselves, even though they'd been trained to not reveal anything of that nature to me. When you're in the capital, you can see me now, and your listeners probably can't. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4". I'm kind of linebacker-sized. And as I would walk through the streets of Pyongyang with my minders in tow, who were obvious officials, as I would move through throngs of people walking fast and very determined, they wouldn't even glance at me. Something in them understood that there was something different ahead, and they wouldn't even risk taking an interest in an unknown thing. They'd ingrained that sense of censorship so deeply within themselves.
It sounds as though you're writing kind of a Korean version of Orwell's 1984.
Well, you know, we don't need fiction to make a 1984. The Kim regime has done it. They have total control. The country's quite geographically isolated. And I think an important thing about that country is that there's no alternative version to the one the Kim regime has put out. There are no magazines there. There are no other newspapers. The radios come off the assembly line without a dial because they're preset to the government station. And if you tamper with them, that's the kind of thing that can get you and your family sent to Camp 15.
Where did you stay?
Oh, the Pyongyang hotels are really a very interesting topic in and of themselves. I stayed on the Yanggak Hotel on Yanggak Island. It's the Yanggakdo Hotel. It's a 47-story building. It's in the middle of the Taedong River, so you have to take a bridge from the city out to it. You need a permit to get an off-ramp onto the island. And to leave the island, you have to be with an official minder. When I was at the hotel, and they love to make these show hotels to make themselves look worldly and urbane and prosperous. But at the hotel, all the staff were Chinese workers on contract. So there, I couldn't even meet a North Korean receptionist or wait person in the lobby. I was to have no contact. They only open up the DPRK a couple weeks a year, unless you're there on diplomatic or business, you know, purposes. I was there as a tourist. And even so, at the height of these travel seasons, when they turn on the power all night and make the city look like a showcase, they start up all the fountains and turn on all the lights. Even then, there were only enough tourists to fill the 32nd floor, which I was on, and the 6th floor, and the whole rest of the hotel was dark. And one of the strangest, creepiest things I've done is I went to the top of the hotel. And they didn't watch me there because they assumed I could get into no trouble on that island. And I went down the fire escape through all those dark floors and started wandering them. And what I discovered was that they'd been cannibalizing the other floors, stealing the fixtures and the toilets and the doors and ripping up the carpets from the unused parts of the hotel to keep a couple floors showy and looking new, which also seemed like a metaphor for that whole nation.
Was there anything akin to room service?
Well, the Korean people are a wonderful people. They have a great sense of hospitality. I only met that through the minders. The Yanggakdo Hotel famously has no 5th floor. The elevator button goes from 4 to 6. And I didn't dare go on the 5th floor, but, you know, people have snuck onto the 5th floor and put their videos on YouTube, and you can just, you know, YouTube up Yanggakdo Hotel 5th floor, and that's where they have all the surveillance equipment and all the rooms where they monitor the rest of the hotel. But really, I think their spy measures are fairly primitive and fairly limited.
You know, you spoke in your article in the Daily Beast about the photographs you took and realized almost immediately that other people who had been there had taken the identical photographs because those are the only ones available.
The trip there is quite canned. Everyone is shown the exact same things. So, you know, what I experienced there was what they wanted me to experience. But when you're there, it's so surreal. It's unlike anything you've ever seen before. So it feels like you're having an utterly unique, genuine experience. And when I came home and put my pictures up on Flickr and saw that everyone had taken the picture of the same bell hanging from the roof of the International Friendship Museum, etc., it was only then in my own office that I realized completely how canned it was. And yet, you know, there are things that they don't... that are so surreal they don't understand it. The first place they took me in Pyongyang was to the Korean History Museum, and the first exhibit was a big room. And in the room there was a pedestal, and on top of it was a plexiglass box, and in the box was a brown piece of what looked like bark. And the docent of the museum, who has no PhD in history, she's someone who's trained to read a script, all the minders were watching me, and she explained to me that this was a skull fragment, and that it was 4.5 million years old, and that it was found in the Taedong River. And when there's no evidence for something in North Korea, they make a big painting as proof, and a diorama. And with a pointer, she showed me how humanity had evolved in Pyongyang, and it had spread up through Asia, out through Europe, and finally down into South Korea, America, and Africa last, was what last place Koreans colonized. And she ended her lecture by saying, "So we are all Korean." And she informed me that I was actually Korean.
What is your background?
You know, my family's from South Dakota, Norwegian farmers. My grandmother was a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux. So all American Midwest folks, I suppose.
Surely they must have done a thorough investigation of you before allowing you into the country. And the fact that you were a writer, a teacher at Stanford University, wouldn't that necessarily put a red flag on your visit?
What happens in Pyongyang, I think, is deeply mysterious. The thing about North Korea is it's almost impossible to verify anything you learn about that place. the death for Kim Jong-il. We don't know its circumstances. There was no autopsy. We don't know anything about how, when, where, why it happened. About the average people in North Korea, the normal citizens who are outside of Pyongyang, the center of power, I think we know a great deal. 6,000 people defected last year. It's a very arduous thing to defect. The country's quite mountainous. You have to cross the Yalu or the Tumen River. Once you get to southern China, because of a repatriation agreement, it's easy to become enslaved, to become a forced wife, because all one citizen of China has to do is make a phone call and you're sent back to North Korea to face perilous consequences for that. Then people
How do you know that?
Oh, there are, you know, tons and tons and tons of missionaries and NGOs. Actually, the missionary community are one of the most active communities attempting to help North Koreans through their defection. But the way we know these things is this. Once people finally make it to South Korea, there's a facility called Hanawon. And at Hanawon, the thousands of people who make it out live there for a month to 4 months, depending on their age and circumstances. And there, the first thing that happens is they're debriefed by officials to see if they might be agents posing as defectors. They caught two in October who were attempting an assassination in South Korea. But more importantly, they make a little portrait of every single person. And it's through these that we know how many calories of food people get a day, how many hours they work, what possessions they had, how much they had to volunteer, their group criticism sessions. Also at Hanawon, people are prepared for a different kind of society, one with stoplights and ATM machines, where you have to pay rent for where you live, and basic social interactions. In the West, we might walk up to someone and say, "Hey, how's it going?" That's a dangerous and aggressive question for someone who's freshly from North Korea.
Adam Johnson, his new novel is titled The Orphan Master's Son, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Adam, tell us more about John Doe. I must say that name does sound an awful lot like John Doe. Mm-hmm. But tell us about his life as it evolves in the novel.
Well, earlier I mentioned this notion of in America we're supposed to define ourselves and take risks and chances to become our best possible selves. But in North Korea, you must fulfill a role. And so this character starts off as a model citizen. He does what he's told, when he's told. He doesn't ask questions. He might actually seem like a flat character for a Western reader at the beginning of the book. But he meets some Americans in the Sea of Japan, and he gets a look at a different narrative of how people might live. And he is assigned to a listening post where he's supposed to intercept messages. And really, he can listen to news and stories out there that he didn't know existed. And it plants the seeds in him that there might be a different way. Still, he does not defect. It's only when he's shown that he's truly disposable by that regime.
How?
Well, he is sent to prison. And a lot of people who travel overseas, who get too much bad influence from other cultures that might spread this to other people in the nation, this alternative narrative, are often sequestered on labor camps. And, you know, we have many examples of that. And then once he sees the darkest place of his own nation, he decides to define himself, write his own script. And the story becomes one about love. There's the nation's actress, Sun Moon. She's a fantastic character. I loved writing her. She's a diva of North Korean propaganda movies. And our character, Jun Do, falls in love with her. And she has acted only in movies that have glorified the state. And she has never seen a real movie. And together, in a wonderful moment, they watch an American movie. The movie's Casablanca. And she sees that in this movie, a story can be about a character. It can be about a love.
And a choice.
And she realizes that she has to become a real actress, that everything she's ever done has been a lie, and that she has to get to Hollywood. And she says to our character, Jun Do, "You must get me there." and he begins to rewrite the whole script of Pyongyang to make that happen.
When you worked on this female character, on whom did you draw?
Well, I drew on a lot of narratives. I drew on the love part for the love I have between my wife, Stephanie, and myself. She's the love of my life. And I tried to, you know, incorporate that as the basis of these two. But opera is beloved in Pyongyang, as are the movies. They're really worth watching. So I had lots of models.
Adam Johnson. And his new book is titled The Orphan Master's Son. When we come back, we're going to open the phones, take your calls, read your email, look at your postings on Facebook and Twitter. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the coming tsunami of slime in the presidential campaign. Journalist Joe Hagan says the emergence of super PACs has changed the game, bringing an unprecedented flood of special interest money to fund opposition research and negative ads. Hagan's article was published in New York Magazine. Join us.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning. And what a great humanitarian service you both are, both for writing the book and focusing on it. We always hear about North Korea in terms of nuclear weapons. I wish we heard more often about human rights. It doesn't matter the weapons they have. If the purpose of those weapons is to preserve a system that it has work camps of hundreds of thousands of people, I have nothing to do with Korea, but it's almost become a passion for me, and I cannot understand why our country and the world is so mute on the issue. And second, you mentioned Orwell, and I'm just hoping this book will also be like Uncle Tom's Cabin, a book which really created an emotional connection in the United States against slavery. I hope that the same thing will happen here, that enough people will read it to feel that, you know, this is something that is not happening 100 years ago. This is, well, you know, we're well advised not to mention Stalin and Hitler as, you know, comparisons, but this is one case where it's not too far off. It's not right on point.
Do you agree with that?
I think what's happening in the DPRK is the most wicked human experiment that people have ever conjured, actually. And thank you, caller, for those comments. I really tried to capture the human dimension as best I could. But you know what? I needed lots of research and lots of imagination to do it. And we won't know whether the version I've created is accurate or not until freedom does come to the DPRK.
And that is precisely what Carol from Reston, Virginia emails. She says, Adam Johnson's description of North Korea today reminds me of my travel experiences in China in the early 80s. At that time, few Westerners would have imagined how far and how fast China would come, thanks largely to the leadership of Deng Xiaoping. What does Adam Johnson imagine for the next generation of North Koreans?
Wow, this is a difficult question, one that I've pondered a great deal. The idea here is that the control is absolutely total right now. The only way people can have an alternative possibility there is to escape. It can't happen within the confines of the nation right now. We don't know who's in power. Pyongyang is a total mystery because very few people defect from there. So we don't get their information. We don't have human intelligence there. We have like satellite images. All I do know is that the Kim story is necessary. Whoever's in power needs Kim Jong-un because the people don't know any other possible narrative for how their lives might work. So we don't know if he's in charge, if it's a military junta, if it's the aunt, if it's the uncle. But something will happen. It must break at some point.
And are they simply, is their acquiescence simply ingrained from generation to generation?
Well, at what point do people remember having a land with art, with books, with their own family traditions, where they were allowed to follow their own heritage? You have to remember that the Japanese brutally occupied Korea from 1910 to the end of the war, 35 years in which they conscripted 5 million Koreans to be slave labor. That totally decimated the culture of the entire peninsula. And on top of that comes World War II, then the Korean War, then a repressive regime for 60 years. So it's really been a century since people have been allowed to lead their own lives for their own purposes.
And I asked you while we were off the air where you were staying. You told me, you said you had enjoyed going into art galleries. What kind of art galleries are there in North Korea?
Well, the National Museum is in Pyongyang. It's a really fantastic facility. It has like 400 grand paintings in there. You walk into the first room, and can I ask you what subject matter you think would be on the paintings?
Someone in military garb.
That's right. There's an entire large first forum of paintings of Kim Jong-il. He's on horseback. He's staring boldly out at the waves. He's saluting the people. Peasant children are hugging him. And then you go into a room of paintings of Kim Il-sung and then Kim Jong-suk. And so there's no subject matter for an artist there except that glorifies the regime.
All right, to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Robert.
Yeah, good morning. This is a very fascinating program, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
What I wanted to ask your guest, and we have, I'm on a landline, but we have a bad connection, so I'll take the answer on the air.
All right.
What I wanted to ask your guest is, how can such a poor country afford a nuclear weapons program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not an expert on the weapons program. There are people who are very dedicated to that who would be able to answer that question better. But the key that we see at every turn is just a reckless disregard for the value of the lives of the people there. And you know, in the 90s, that was a terrible decade for that nation. The Soviet Union discontinued much of the support that had kept the country going. there were some horrible floods in 95 and 96, and the Great Famine, you know, came during that period. And we don't even know how many people died. We don't know how many people actually live in North Korea, but the estimates range conservatively from 600,000, and they go all the way to 3 million. But probably 10% of the population was allowed to just starve to death during the promulgation of this nuclear program. So the priorities of the regime are clear.
You mentioned that your character, Jean Doe, does go to prison. Would you read for us, and this particular portion is not Jean Doe speaking, but one of his interrogators.
That's right. This is from later in the book. I'll read the excerpt. There is a talk that every father has with his son, in which he brings the child to understand that there are ways we must act, things we must say. But inside, we're still us. We're still family. I was 8 when my father had this talk with me. We were under a tree on Moranbang Hill. He told me that there was a path set out for us. On it, we had to do everything the signs commanded and heed all the announcements along the way. Even if we walked this path side by side, he said, we must act alone on the outside, while on the inside, we would be holding hands. On Sundays, the factories were closed, so the air was clear, and I could imagine this path ahead, stretching across the Taedong Valley, a path lined with willows and vaulted by singular white clouds moving as a group. We ate berry-flavored ices and listened to the sounds of old men at their changi boards, slapping cards in a spirited game of gostop. Soon my thoughts were of toy sailboats like the ones the Yangban kids were playing with at the pond. But my father was still walking me down that path. He said to me, I denounce this boy for having a blue tongue. And we laughed. I pointed at my father. This citizen eats mustard, I said to him. I'd recently tried mustard for the first time, and the look on my face had made my parents laugh. My father addressed an invisible authority in the air. This boy has counter-revolutionary thoughts about mustard. He should be sent to a farm to correct his mustardly thinking. Now take my hand, my father said to me. I put my small hand in his, and then his mouth became sharp. He said to me, I denounce this citizen as an imperialist puppet who should be remanded to stand trial for crimes against the state. His face was red and venomous. I've witnessed this boy spew capitalist diatribes in an effort to poison our minds with his filth. The old men turned from their game to observe us. I was terrified, on the verge of crying. My father said, see, my mouth said that, but my hand was holding yours. If your mother ever must say something like that to me, in order to protect the two of you, know that inside she and I are holding hands. And if someday you must say something like that to me, I'll know it's not really you. That's inside. Inside is where the father and son will always be holding hands.
Wow. If Jean Doe is able to somehow break away and rise up and escape, is it the love inside that he has that gives him finally the power to do that? And if he has that power, why is it that many more do not?
Well, the Korean people are just as human as we are. All people are the same, I believe. They have the same motivations and desires, the need to have hope and love. This section I wrote here was about me thinking about my 3 children, who are 9, 7, and 5. I was trying to think about what it would be like to live in a land where they might see some grim outcome from one of our family members. How would I prepare them for that? You know, how would I get them? Would I risk telling them that I thought everything was a lie? Or would I let them believe the lie because it would allow them to more safely traverse the society and be less likely to be imperiled? And then there's the question of, what does it mean to survive if you have nothing to live for? That's the choice that the character in my book must finally make. Is he going to be a survivor, or is he going to have something that is worth living for?
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Diane. Big fan of the show.
Thank you.
I was just calling. In 2003, I went to North Korea. I worked on board merchant ships who delivered food for the World Food Program. And I got to go to Nampo, just Pyongyang, and another port city on the East Coast. And what really fascinated me and what really kind of, you know, captured me was the brainwash, the people, the general population, how they were brainwashed into, you know, I guess believing that North Korea was the best country in the world. And it was interesting to see how they looked at us. Here we are, well-dressed in our Carhartts or clothes and, you know, giving them food. And here they are in their, you know, because there are, I mean, sewn 100 times and bear no shoes on. And, you know, you can see through the dirt. But yet they'll stay there and tell you how great they are and how horrible we were. And it was just that really took me, you know, that, and it's kind of almost sad how, you know, the only thing they knew is what their government told them.
I experienced the exact same thing that the caller spoke of. I was constantly told how North Korea was a workers' paradise, that they had universal health care. They often said that they were the most democratic nation in the world. They told me that their voter turnout was 99.9%, while in America it was often a paltry 50 or 60%. They had lots of, you know, stock moments to enlist responses. For instance, one of my minders kept using little prompts. He would say, "What do you think of terrorism, Professor Johnson?" You know, and I would say, "I think terrorism is bad." And he would say, "Let me tell you what Kim Jong-il thinks of terrorism." And they were constantly promulgating all these notions of self-glorification. And yet it was obvious that we had cameras, that I had, you know, an iPod. They were very curious to look at that device. And, you know, on some level, I believe, and this is the feeling I got that I can't verify when I was there, I believe that they knew the version, the lone version that they get there was not true. But because there's no alternative, they don't know what is true, what life might be like in other places. In Pyongyang, we don't know. Supposedly, there were cell phone towers everywhere. So someone's using cell phones, which means they can have the internet, which means they can have movies, etc.
Adam Johnson's book is titled The Orphan Master's Son, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm wondering about the reviews that you've gotten on this book. One reviewer felt you shouldn't be writing such a fun novel about one of the worst places on Earth. What do you feel about that criticism?
Well, I would say that, you know, what is a society without humor? Are those humorless people? And I also think humor is everywhere in life, and it's a necessary balancing element to darkness. And that the true darkness of North Korea, the reality of it was, you know, so heavy that I had to keep a lot of it out of the book. But there are grim moments in the book. There are black portraits. And I think a tension builds in the reader that needs to be released. And without humor, the humanity of the people wouldn't be complete that I was trying to depict.
Even with your minders present, were you able to talk to ordinary people?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Mm-mm. And how long were you there?
Well, you know, they only open up North Korea at certain times in the year. They tell you when you're going to arrive and when you're going to leave. So I was there for, I believe, about 6 days.
You must have gotten lonely.
Well, I was fascinated every moment. Even when I had a spare moment in my hotel, I just stared out at Pyongyang at night and looked at the Kwangbok Express buses racing by.
Do you speak the language?
Well, if I'd have known I was going to spend 6 years writing a novel on North Korea,
you would have learned.
The first thing I would have done was learn Korean.
But you didn't.
No, I didn't. And I wish I would have. It's such a beautiful culture. I think it's a beautiful language. I became, you know, fascinated with, you know, Sanjo music and all the cultural traditions. I don't know how I got so obsessed about this culture. But the more, Even being in Pyongyang and seeing all those people I couldn't talk to, that I couldn't get to know, whose stories I couldn't hear, amplified my desire to individuate them, to bring them to life. And I had to use my imagination and research to do that because it was impossible. And I don't know if my version is the right one. Only when North Korean artists and painters and filmmakers are finally free enough to tell their own stories will we finally know.
How long do you think it will be?
Oh, I hope change comes. I hope it comes slowly, honestly, gradually, because there's so much for them to learn that it might be very chaotic to happen quickly.
Adam Johnson, and his new novel is titled The Orphan Master's Son. It's published by Random House. Congratulations.
It's been a wonderful interview. Thanks for
having
me.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CNN.